For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. On Tuesday, Republican leaders promised to keep funding education. Incoming Senate President Pro Tem Greg Treat says despite what he calls fear-mongering on social media, his party is committed to continue funding the teacher pay. And returning House Speaker Charles McCall says he and his caucus hope for more education funding in the coming session. Neva, what do you think of this commitment?
I think the commitment is understood on all parties at the Capitol. Education has always been the core issue that was addressed first and foremost. The debate has been in the funding aspect and how much and how do you get there. But I think the thing that Speaker McCall said in that particular setting that I think is noteworthy is that he said, While education is a priority, an equal priority is going to be educational outcomes. And I think with that, what we're hearing is that there's going to be some real significant looks at structural changes to education and to be able to really see what the results are for the money that's being expended. So I think this is part of the larger conversation that will be ongoing through this next legislative session. And I don't think it's a surprise to anyone that these legislative leaders are kind of teaming it up in this fashion.
Ryan.
Well, I mean, it's, and everybody please excuse me this week. I've lost my voice. It's coming back. And Neva and I, we've got the show where we normally don't shout at each other, but that's especially not this week. You know, I would just say that it's, you know, we're in December of 2018, you know, trying to forecast what the budget outcome is going to be for, you know, May of 2019 is reading tea leaves that nobody can really understand right now or appreciate. You know, we do know some dynamics, that we've got an incoming governor who has said that he would have vetoed the new revenue sources. So the idea of new revenue sources coming on the table seems to be kind of out of the question right now, unless he does a George H.W. Bush of no new taxes and changes his mind during this first term of his administration, which I don't really see happening. So every year at the Capitol is going to be a battle for funding. Education did get more than they probably anticipated last year, but they're nowhere near where they need to be from a decade plus of cuts to education. You have corrections that needs way more money than they're going to get, healthcare that needs way more money than it's going to get. So every dollar at the state capitol is going to have a lot of interest fighting for it, and a lot of very compelling interest fighting for it. So, you know, I would say the commitments right now are encouraging. But, you know, for people to be worried about where funding is ultimately going to end up, I don't think that that's fear-mongering at all. I think it's just real concern over a limited amount of dollars for a lot of competing interests.
I think the point, though, what Governor-elect did to remember is that it was not just the approach of we wouldn't fund more dollars to education. It was how that would be funded. That was really his whole argument and discussion throughout the campaign, was not about trying to make education preeminent and really the centerpiece of Oklahoma in terms of where dollars are expended and the results are garnered, but it really is how do you get there. And I think we will see some different approaches and some different dialogue in that regard with the incoming Republican governor and with this new legislature.
And at some point you have to focus on other forms of education. Oklahoma Education Television Authority, which has been cut dramatically. Colleges, universities, which have gotten dramatic cuts over the past
years. We spoke last
week
about the unfunded endowment positions at universities in the state of Oklahoma. There are a lot, and I know that Governor-elect Stitt has been saying that it's not a matter of not funding education, but during the campaign trail, whenever when he was pressed on where does that money come from, he really didn't have an answer for that. And you know, the Democratic candidate, Drew Edmondson, he wanted to raise taxes, in particular on oil and gas companies. So there was this path of new revenue. I think that if we're going to see more revenue go to education without new revenue on the table, it probably means that somebody else loses.
I think the other thing, though, is when you talk about revenue, when you're starting with education, getting more than half of the state budget, more than half of the appropriated dollars at the outset, I mean, that's the discussion point to start from. And I think it's not that there's not more needed. It is how to best allocate that and what type of results we should expect for those additional dollars that are put on the table.
One quick way to put some money into the state budget without raising taxes right now would be to expand Medicaid. And we do that. We put more money into the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority. That would free up a lot of money that could be spent anywhere else, including education.
A lot of things to talk about as the session gets nearer. Elected members of the GOP rushed to distance themselves from comments from the chair of the Republican Party of Canadian County. Andrew Lopez sent a letter to lawmakers urging, in essence, the defunding of education and saying his party is betraying its principles and looking to grow the size of government. Ryan, does this letter worry you?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't worry me at all. I think that it does reflect a certain element of the Republican base. I think that there is an element of the Republican base that would just as soon get rid of public education, but they're not the folks that have been prevailing in these primaries. And what we saw in the last primary season, where if you're really going to have races in the state of Oklahoma that are going to be focused around a particular issue, it's really in primaries right now, because I think whenever you get into the general and it's a Republican versus Democrat, partisanship is trumping issues. But in those primaries, Republican candidates that had stood up for education and wanted more funding for education, they either won re-election or they got elected, and folks that stood in the way got thrown out. And so I think that, you know, this is represents some base. Now, there is, you know, folks should pay attention to it. We shouldn't just immediately dismiss it, because, you know, stuff like this, you know, 10 years ago, whenever we first started hearing about Obama and the Affordable Care Act and, you know, all of the stuff, you know, that is the kind of the fuel that leads to things like Breitbart and, you know, even President Donald Trump. So, you know, just because this is out there and it seems totally incredulous right now doesn't mean that we shouldn't pay attention to it. And I'm glad that Republican leadership was quick to dismiss it.
And Neva, a lot of Republicans won on the idea of education and were quick, including the UConn representative, to dismiss what he had said.
Absolutely. I mean, UConn Representative Rhonda Baker, a former classroom teacher herself, now going to chair of the House Education Committee. I think Ryan is correct in this assessment, that when you start talking about comments made from folks that are involved in the political party structure and organization, these are lay people who get together within the framework of both parties, get elected to positions that are unpaid, basically volunteer positions within their counties, and I think oftentimes we see them be hyper-partisan, be very willing to kind of take sometimes positions on the extreme edges. I think both parties can see that this has happened in recent years in within their political frameworks, and I think we have to keep it in context. I mean, it's a way for them to get a headline. It's a way for them to get some attention. But at the end of the day, it really has very little to do other than give them their proper voice within the framework of party organization structure to be able to advocate for the issues that they want to see those folks that go to the legislature perhaps take into consideration.
Senate bills are already getting filed, and two familiar ones were announced late last week. Senate Bill 13 makes abortion a homicide. A similar bill failed to get a hearing last year. Senate Bill 12 lets anyone carry a gun concealed or unconcealed without a license. Governor Fallon vetoed the bill earlier this year, but Governor-elect Kevin Stitt has signaled support for so-called constitutional carry. Neva, what do you think will happen to these bills?
I think these are the types of bills that get a lot of attention early pre-session in terms of speculation and conversation, but we'll have to just wait and see. I think what we saw last time with the result in both of those instances may well be the case again. I mean, even with the change in the legislature, I think when you actually put a bill through the process, I mean, the give and take and the real structure to be able to vet these ideas and to make sure that that they have the proper hearing rather than just kind of throw the hand grenade, so to speak, and just kind of get it out there to have the conversation really stimulated. I would assume that we'll see lots of these types of bills that'll be pre-filed, but the question will be, will there be much focus and attention on those bills as opposed to the bigger issues that we talk about all the time, which really are the looming policy issues about how we are going to really address some of these agencies that have long since been starved to death in terms of appropriated dollars and the need to see some real effective policy changes.
Right.
Maybe these state senators should run for a county party chair out in Canadian County. I mean, it sounds a little bit more in line with what we're seeing. I mean, these two bills would make Oklahomans dramatically less safe, and it would have a wildly negative impact on the Oklahoma women's health care, which is already near the bottom in the country. With the anti-choice legislation that Senator Silk continues to bring forward every year, we can talk about his disregard for women and their ability to make have autonomy over this incredibly important choice for themselves and their bodies and what that means for their health care. But I mean, it's we've said it all before. The real test here is whether or not leadership lets this bill move forward. You know, when it didn't get a hearing last year, that sent a signal that this, you know, this bill is dangerous. It goes way too far, even for the Republican caucus, and it doesn't deserve the light of day. Hopefully that will be the case again this year. With constitutional carry, let's stop calling it constitutional carry, because if it were constitutional carry, we wouldn't need a statute to do it. You could just go carry it. You know, the idea of putting more guns onto the streets, in particular in situations where people are carrying them without any licensing or any training, is just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. We are a state right now that has so much underdiagnosed and undertreated mental illness, and we put, when we throw in guns with that, I mean, just drive around in the streets right now and you look at road rage. I mean, the number of times, you know, people, you know, freak out and do things that they would never do in their normal life. Now you put a gun into that context, and it just makes it radically more dangerous. And so I really hope that, you know, Governor-elect Stitt, you know, I understand on a campaign you're trying to get the NRA's endorsement. This is what he wants to do. I'm hoping that he checked that box, but now that he's got the guts and he begins to hear from folks, in particular law enforcement, it was OSBI and a lot of law enforcement folks that stepped up and talked to Governor Fallon and said, this is dangerous. It makes our agents and our officers less safe and makes the people of Oklahoma less safe. And she listened. I hope Governor-elect Stitt will too.
And while these bills might not pass, Neva, the problem, I guess some people will say with these bills, is it gives a bad light on the national, so for people wanting to move here, businesses wanting to move here, they see these bills and it makes them maybe think twice about doing
so.
Well,
we perhaps sensationalize some of these bills too prematurely, I think is a big part of this. I mean, if there are 1,000 bills or whatever number of bills that are thrown into the hopper, I mean, we pick one or two that have a little bit of sizzle, and also, as Ryan says, are ones that I mean, historically have had less traction. I mean, there are many opportunities for lawmakers to put bills into the process. And frankly, let's remember, part of that process is to listen to constituents back home who want certain pieces of legislation, who want certain ideas, you know, put forward in terms of whether they can be promulgated as statute or rules. And so I think there's that give and take of everyone needs to have their voice heard. And in some cases, that means that a bill finally makes its way into the and is filed and goes through some level of process in the legislature. And I think that's a healthy give and take. I think the lawmakers at the end of the day get to press the red or green button and decide whether this is really good public policy, good legislation for the vast majority of Oklahomans.
The state epidemiologist was forced to resign last year after more than 20 years with the department. It was later learned Christy Bradley, who resigned under protest, was one of the first to react to the agency's financial troubles last year. She notified the federal government about misspending of funds. A spokesperson says Bradley wasn't let go because of the financial mess. Ryan, what do you think about the ouster of Bradley?
Well, I think that it's a loss to lose somebody with that much institutional memory and history with the state of Oklahoma, that kind of public service and intelligence about the way the department works, the way these grant programs work. You know, we talked last week about there's a piece of legislation starting in the Senate to create greater oversight within the legislature. Oftentimes the best oversight that we have within these agencies are the folks that work there themselves, these public servants that know these programs in and out. It was the state's epidemiologist who saw that the Ryan White funding was being misspent. It was being applied to payroll instead of being used for AIDS care in the state of Oklahoma. And that was, you know, she was the one who noticed that, you know, and you know, that's so deep in the weeds in spending whenever you're talking about an agency that has tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars passing through it, you know, state and federal, to be able to find something like that. So to lose a public servant there, you know, we don't know what the circumstances are. Obviously, the state is saying that they can't comment because it's a personnel matter. But it does, you know, regardless of the circumstances, and it does look, you know, the optics are not great here for anyone, But it does, whenever you lose that intelligence in an agency, we've lost one of the best pieces of oversight that we've got over state government.
And what is the worst thing is when I read the story, Neva, it sounded like they had basically ousted a whistleblower, which has got to draw some concern.
Well, and I think the question is what are the real facts? And we may not know based on the fact that that this is a personnel matter. I do think it's important to note that that the interim commissioner Tom Bates did make the statement that he had conducted a thorough review of the supervisory conduct of the individuals that had been asked for their resignation. So, I mean, there are some personnel elements to this that that are certainly not for public consumption and may very well really factor into this, even though the optics, as you say, given the fact that there's been a storyline already out there, given the fact that the department has had the black eye through the year with all of the mismanagement and all of the budget crisis, you know, real or imagined as it unfolded. I think it is important in all of these agencies to make sure, particularly with this incoming transition, changing of the guard, that we begin to see that that there is a thorough review of all of the folks that are in major management and supervisory positions, and that we know that they are really performing at the level that's expected and properly conducting themselves as well.
Well, it's possible for the public to know. The lawmakers could certainly delve into this because it's they can certainly, even if it is a personal matter, they can subpoena, they can look into why this person would be fired.
And, you know, and I think that they should be asking those questions because, you know, while there may be personnel matters here that we're not privy to and, you know, could make for a very legitimate termination and we're just not aware of them. I mean, sitting here in this, in our recording booth, we don't have all of those facts to make that determination.
But we're also an at-will state. And I think that's an important point that sometimes gets lost in many of these conversations when we start talking about personnel changes or personnel exits. I mean, and I think we may see more of that as time passes. And the question will be, and you're right, the legislature definitely has a role in that they can ask questions and they can be involved because of their, you know, oversight and budget component in terms of the appropriating the money for these agencies. But I think this is kind of a headline chasing, you know, facts that we don't really know. And I think it will be interesting to see if more comes out in the days to come.
Any firing here in this context is going to be suspect. I mean, we're just because of the nature of what we're talking about.
Because it's the health department that had financial troubles.
The real concern for the public here is whether or not the firing was because she was a whistleblower. And if she was fired because she was a whistleblower in an at-will state or not, because we have to rely on these public servants within these agencies, these civil servants there, we should need to protect them. And so if legislators feel like there's some whistleblower retribution here, they should definitely look into that. But, you know, I do think that it's impossible and not wise for folks to begin to project, you know, what they think may have happened here onto this headline without further facts.
Finally, this week, the United States said goodbye to its 41st president, George H.W. Bush. I just wanted to get your thoughts on his passing. Neva, let's start with you.
Well, first of all, I mean, I had the incredible privilege and opportunity in 1992 to serve as the state director of the Bush-Quayle campaign and had the privilege of meeting the president on more than one occasion. And he certainly, I think, as we've seen reflected in talking about his legacy, something he never wanted to talk about, we saw really the amazing character of President Bush. I mean, here's someone who, when you talk about him, you think of words like modesty and courtesy and restraint and respect and civility. And I mean, you can go on and on. And those were words that over and over again we heard uttered from those who had been on both sides of the political aisle and who, in some instances, had been described as political opponents and some would say political enemies. But he really didn't have political enemies. He was someone who, he was really a statesman. He was someone who I think is the best example of a true public servant and American hero that I've seen in my lifetime next to Ronald Reagan. And so my heartfelt condolences go out to the Bush family. And I think it's been a wonderful reflection to see that and remind us that, as oftentimes he said, to whom much is given, much is required. And I think he stepped up and his His life of public service demonstrated that fully.
His work's a bipartisan as far as ADA, passage of that, and passage of NAFTA. Or not passage of NAFTA, working on NAFTA, eventually got passed during the Clinton administration. But really showed that you can work across both sides of the aisle.
To be president during the fall of the Soviet Union and the beginnings of the end of the Cold War. I mean, you know, what a remarkable point in history. And, you know, we're reviewing his legacy this week. You know, President George H.W. Bush is the first president that I ever got to meet. I remember, you know, now Neva, the first campaign that I was ever engaged in. Now I was all of 8 years old.
I was gonna say.
I was a strong Michael
Young
Dukakis
man.
Fan. I drew all sorts of Michael Dukakis posters for my room, and I didn't as necessarily know why, but I did. And I think that, you know, there is this legacy of the Bush campaign that's troubling, everything from the Willie Horton ads of the 88 campaign to the fabricated crack cocaine drug scare that they did, where they set up DE agents to make a fake buy in a park across the street from the White House. But, you know, those things are still playing out today. But I think the more important thing that's playing out today is President Bush's respect for democratic institutions and democratic norms, his humility and his grace. In particular, in the face of defeat, political defeat, the greatest political defeat that anyone can experience in the modern era is to lose the presidency after their first term. And the letter and the words of wisdom that he left for President Clinton in that letter in his desk, that handwritten letter that President Clinton found in the desk in the Oval Office whenever he arrived after being sworn in as president, I think is something that, as a nation, stands in stark contrast to what we see today. And when we looked at those presidents sitting at the funeral earlier this week, you know, Republicans and Democrats sitting at that funeral this week, there was a stark contrast with the way that they respected democratic institutions and norms that were very much embodied in the work of President Bush that's missing today in America's politics.
And I think President Bush, his own life code, I mean, was a very simple few sentences, but I think it's something really I would say anyone looking at public service or anyone in elective or public office today should be reminded of often. And it was simply to tell the truth, don't blame people, be strong, do your best, try hard, forgive, stay the course. I mean, if that doesn't summarize what I think all Americans appreciate about the life and legacy of George H.W. Bush, as well as what we want to see in leaders in our nation now and in the decades to come.
Here, here, and to the greatest generation, Bob Dole, 95 years old, standing to salute the casket and the rotunda of the United States Congress. I mean, an amazing moment. Yeah. And this really is, you know, we're beginning to see the loss of this generation, everybody from John McCain to President Bush. And it's not just the passage of a generation, but I think that it's reminding America of what we can be when we stand at our greatest.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.